The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
We got Ron Johnson here, all the way from Louisville, Kentucky. And Ron and I just recently met at the Southern Trial Lawyers. And based upon that conversation, we decided it'd be a good idea to have Ron come out, because I'd only heard about Ron from other lawyers in Kentucky and Jay Vaughn. And so it was kind of cool to run into you there in New Orleans. So we decided that Ron's going to come out to Huntington Beach in June and teach something in Huntington Beach, because we talked about this. He's going to teach something on depositions because he feels like that's his strong suit. Is that right, Ron? You feel depositions are your strong suit?
I think it's my strong suit, and I also think it's the most important part of a case.
It's true, because you need the evidence. I mean, you have a great story, but without evidence, and we say, not to be political, but it's not Trump country. You can't just make stuff up. You actually have to have facts and evidence in a court of law.
Right.
It has to be tested. You can't just say stuff. You can, but it doesn't usually fly in a court of law. It might fly in the newspaper, might fly, you know, on TV, but not in the court of law. So Ron has a little bit different start than most of the trial lawyers I get to connect with. So Ron, how did you get started on your journey in Louisville to become the trial lawyer you are today?
So when I was in law school, I clerked and worked for a group of criminal defense lawyers and really loved that work, loved how they were in the courtroom all the time. I also had another clerkship with a big law firm, so I got to see that as well. And when I graduated, I got an offer from each place. And the big law firm offered me, which in the year 2000 was a lot of money for a young guy, 80 plus grand a year. And the criminal defense guys offered me 30 grand a year. But the best decision I ever made was I turned down the big law firm and went in with the criminal defense guys, got sworn in early. They took me over to a Supreme Court justice who was in Louisville, got me sworn in early. And I was doing an arraignment at 1 p.m. that day. So hit the ground running, so to speak.
That's what I started at, too. It was about $30,000 a year working for my dad because I was a house painter back then. So I was making a lot more than that, like two or three times that working during the summer. But my dad's like, I'm going to start you for $30,000 a year. I'm like, that's nothing. That's not even $20 an hour. I can't remember how cheap it was. He's like, yeah, you don't know anything. And you know, as long as you have enough money to get your laundry, your dry cleaning done, that'll be enough for you. I'm like, okay, if you say so. But it's a frugal, but that was a few years before you. So, you know, maybe in 1997, there was $500 a week was more money. And going to the courtroom without any experience was nerve-wracking as hell. I think it took me about 6 months to stop stuttering in the courtroom because I was so insecure about what was going on. But eventually, we worked our way through that. So how long did you spend at the criminal defense?
I wasn't with those guys really that long, as long as I thought I would be, because in less than a year of being with them, one of the sort of legendary big time plaintiff's lawyers in Louisville called me out of the blue and said he had heard about me or knew about me and wanted to know if I wanted to come talk to him about working for him. This guy's name is Joe White. He's retired, but I knew, of course, who he was, and I was unbelievably excited to go over to his office and interview for a job. And so he gave me one, and that was it.
How long did that last for with Joe White?
I was with Joe from basically the end of 2000 through end of 2006. So I spent 6 years with him and learned not everything that I use today, but a lot of what I use today I learned from him.
Did you get to try cases with him?
We did, yeah. And the first case that he and I tried together, it was outside of Louisville. It was a Med-Mal case, about 45 minutes away. And we didn't stay down there. We stayed at home and we drove down every morning. And it was funny because he did voir dire and then we did that in day one. We did motions limine and then voir dire. And then the next morning was going to be openings. And I had worked the case up. I had done all the depots and everything. And so that morning driving down to trial, he just turned to me in that 45 minutes and he said, think you can handle the opening? You know, with no preparation, And I kind of flipped out a little bit, but I did it and ended up getting to do a lot more in that trial than I ever, I thought I should be carrying his briefcase, but I actually did quite a bit.
Well, you know, and it's fortunate for you that you had a mentor like Joe, because I think most lawyers don't have a mentor. I mean, because unless you're willing to go work for a great lawyer and get lucky enough to actually connect with a great lawyer, it's kind of hard to get somebody just to invest in you and coach you unless there's something in it for them. But that's kind of, it's one of the reasons why I was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time to start Trial Lawyers University, because it's kind of like a mass mentorship for all of us lawyers out there that don't have mentors. Because for me, it was about learning from all the great ones, get to try to figure out how they do stuff so that I can become the greatest trial lawyer of my time. That's still a work in progress. Right now, I'm a really good event planner for trial lawyers. And there's going to be one in Huntington Beach, so people are going to see the level of my event planning skills in Huntington Beach, California, that we'll talk about a little bit. But so you got that first trial under your belt, and you stayed with Joe. How many trials did you do with Joe over those 6 years? Or not with him, or get to do?
Yeah, probably about three or four. I mean, to be quite honest, Joe was so well-known and so well-respected and took such good cases that most defense lawyers settled with him. So didn't get to try a whole lot of cases with him, but again, learned so much from him. And Jay Vaughn, my law partner, who you know well, he knows I quote Joe White constantly.
What's a Joe White quote?
So one of the things that Joe used to say, because when you're doing plaintiff's work, you're not representing a company or, you know, an insurance company or whatever. You're representing real people who have real problems. And some of these people can be, you know, trouble. And Joe's most famous saying was, if it wasn't for the clients, this shit would be easy.
I think a lot of people have adopted that one, because I hear some version of that frequently from a lot of plaintiff's lawyers. Like, this job's great, other than the clients occasionally. But it's, you know, it's tough to be a client, because, you know, these people are hurt, they're desperate, their lives are broken. I mean, most of them, I think, suffer from chronic depression, but it's been significantly injured. How could you not? When everything's going along one day, the next day you're sitting at home by yourself, staring out at the window. So that's why it takes a lot of compassion to do this job.
It wasn't a put down of the clients at all. It was a comment about how the lawyering part is kind of the easy part,
right?
You know, once you get good at it, like he was. But dealing with the human part, which is a critical part of being a plaintiff's lawyer, that's the hard part, is the hand-holding and the empathy and understanding what these people are going through. That's the difference between someone who's born to be a plaintiff's lawyer and someone who's not.
Right, somebody who just becomes a plaintiff's lawyer because they were a defense lawyer, but they realize they hate billing hours, want to make a lot more money. So they just switch roles, but they never switch their mindset or their empathy or their, I guess, caring. Because you see that a lot too, or like prosecutors that, oh, they want to become criminal defense lawyers, but they suck because they got no heart for it. They're like, oh, I only got paid so-and-so, I'm not going to work that hard on it. Instead of like, somebody's life is in my hands. How could I ever stop working until the verdict's read? Somebody trusts you with that much. But somebody that's on a mission, a mercenary, and a true believer, I guess, would be it. There's a big difference, you know, in the attitude people come with. So you spent 6 years with Joe White, and where'd you go from there? I never asked you, how many cases did you get to try as a criminal defense lawyer? Because that's a good place to get started.
Dan, you did criminal defense work, you know. I mean, it's so different, and it's just so much more fast-paced. So it's some of those cases you can try in a day, because the only, do you have maybe a witness and the police officer? That, yeah, I don't know, a lot, because a lot of those were small trials. You know, some of them were misdemeanors. Some of them were bench trials, because you don't get a jury necessarily like with a DUI case. So those were short and fast, and there were lots of them, and it was fun. I think what you said earlier, it teaches you just to be on your feet, to stop stuttering, to stop being nervous, and to develop a comfort in the courtroom when you're doing it that often. I think it was a great experience for me, and I think it laid a great foundation.
And cross-examining cops, I think, is so similar to cross-examining defense expert, especially a doctor, because most cops have a lot of respect from our society, just like doctors. Most juries believe that they won't lie just to prove their side and that they don't have a horse in the race. Whereas we know that, I mean, most civil plaintiff's lawyers know that doctors will lie at the drop of a dime. for the money. And they're really good liars. And I mean, they're really smart, professional liars. And it was crazy. Like, the majority of police officers that I've cross-examined as a criminal defense lawyer, I would say were sociopathic liars. And people are like, oh, that's not nice to say. I'm like, it may not be nice to say, but it was still the truth. I mean, they were pliant and pleasant people in everyday conversation until you challenged them, you know, on their investigation. And then they would say and do whatever they had to do to prove themselves to be right and justify and to quote, win their conviction, instead of just whatever officer or cop was like, just completely objective and just say whatever he did and not have a horse in the race. Those were the toughest ones, because it's like, this guy is just, this is what people expect. Not the, as soon as they start lying and exaggerating, it was like, you know, if you're ready for it, it's just like smacking them around and watching them start to heat up and you see the anger and like they're, so I think it's good practice being a criminal defense lawyer for just being in the courtroom. I mean, because we always get that time in the courtroom.
Exactly.
But the 6 years, you see Joe White for 6 years. And then where'd you head from there?
Yeah. So the reason I left Joe is I got married and my wife was a professor up at Northern Kentucky University's law school. And that's up right outside of Cincinnati. So she said she had two little kids and a job that she loved. And, I could do the plaintiff's work. I didn't really need to be in one place or the other. So I moved up there. And when I moved up there, I joined the firm where I am now. At the time, my partners were Paul Schachter and Penny Hendy. And Paul's retired. And now the firm is Penny Hendy, myself, and Jay Vaughn, who you know and have had on this podcast. I've been basically at the firm I'm where I am now since 2006.
Wow, that's a nice continuity. And how many lawyers you got over there at Henry? Is it Henry Johnson? And
Hendy. Yeah, Hendy, Johnson, Vaughn. We usually have about five. Right now we have four and we're hiring. So send your resumes. But there's four of us and two are up in the Northern. Penny and Sarah are up in the Northern Kentucky office, which is, we're all licensed in Ohio. So we practice over there as well. So that's sort of our Cincinnati office. And then Jay and I are down here in Louisville. But we do cases all over Kentucky, all over Ohio. And in fact, I still do a fair amount of mass torts. So I actually do cases all over the country.
Anywhere there's an injustice, you'll find Ron Johnson.
That's right.
Got it. All right. So, Ron, let's talk about trial. So getting ready for trial is always a big ordeal. So let's take about the 90 days before trial. What are some of the processes you go through to make sure that case is ready to rock and roll?
So one of the things that I think you have to do early, even before 90 days, but definitely it's sort of your starting point for me, which would be the 90-day mark, more or less, is what's the jury instruction for your case? I still am surprised at the number of lawyers who are looking at jury instructions only at the time that the pretrial order says submit jury instructions. You got to be looking at those early on and thinking about how you're going to fit the pieces of proof to meet those instructions. So that's one of the very first things that I'm doing. And then it's really about theming the case. We use a lot of boards, a lot of demonstratives, and we're making those up at least 90 days before trial. And those are all things that we got in our depositions, which is what I'm going to be talking about out of Trial Lawyers University and why depositions are so important, is that we start developing these boards that we're going to use at trial, taking the testimony, the admissions that we got out of those depositions.
What else are you doing besides getting our admissions set up, getting our themes, reviewing the jury instructions, anything else? Do any final focus groups, anything like that?
So focus groups will have been done earlier, and the data that we get from those focus groups will be part of the theming. But also goes hand in hand with the theming is you got to sit down and map out your order of proof. And that's really important to do sort of at that 90-day mark. Anybody who tries a case understands that you're telling a story. You're walking into a courtroom and you're going to a jury and you're saying there's two different truths that are coming at you. Only one of them can be the real truth and you have to pick which one it is. We're going to tell you this. The defense is going to tell you that. And you have to decide they can't coexist. One of them is the truth and one of them is false. And so you have to be compelling in telling your truth. And anybody who's a great novelist, storyteller, short story writer, person who writes scripts or plays, the order in which you tell the story, the characters come in and out of the story, is part of what makes it convincing or compelling. So sitting down and coming up with your order of proof at the same time you're theming the case and looking at what your focus group data is and what matters to the focus group and what the issues that they identified for you, that becomes hugely important at that early stage of preparation.
And so as we get ready for trial, moving on to, you know, the first stage of trial when you get up there and jury selection or voir dire or voir dire, depending on where you are in this country, what is your philosophy on, when you're approaching jury selection, what is it you're trying to accomplish with it? Except, of course, get you the best jury. Obviously, we all want to get a best jury for our case. That's totally on our side. That's the ultimate accomplishment. But as you think about it, when you walk in, your process and what you go through.
If you're in a venue where you get the jury questionnaires ahead of time, and they contain good information, the ones in Kentucky certainly do, you have to go through those and then immediately start looking at social media, start looking at whatever they do online. That tells you so much. I mean, we couldn't do that 20 years ago, but now that's a big part of what I do for jury selection that I didn't do before, didn't know to do before because it didn't exist, and take copious notes on each person and what they're putting online and what they talk about and who they like and what they don't like, because a lot of that is better than what you can ever get them to say in voir dire. In terms of once I'm in the courtroom, then with that information, some people like to try cases by themselves. Some people always have a co-counsel or second chair or whatever. No matter what, you have to have somebody else with you for jury selection. You cannot do that by yourself because someone's got to be back at the table recording the data as you're getting it from the people. You have to have an approach that gets people talking, because if you're in state court, that's one of the big advantages of being in state court, is the ability for you to do the jury selection instead of the judge. And if you can't squander that, so you've got to get them talking. You have to be that person, like we've been talking about, who's comfortable in the courtroom. It's not the time to be nervous. It's not the time to be stuttering and not communicating with them effectively, because they're nervous. A lot of them, some of them are repeat jurors, but most of them are not. They're scared they're going to say something wrong. You have to put them at ease. And I think a really big important part of getting the voir dire going is making them understand that not every juror is right for every case, and that self-identifying that you're not the right juror for this case is a good thing to do, that you're helping both sides and the court. If you can admit that due to your own personal issues, biases, upbringing, beliefs, religion, that you're not the right person for this case, and that you're going to go back down to the jury room and go get on another case. If you can't communicate to that to them in the beginning, you're never going to get people who are fully disclosing those biases, prejudices, preconceived ideas.
When you first stand up there, and the judge, of course, says, hey, you want to ask some questions? Like, of course you do. Do you have like an opening rapport? I don't want to say shtick, but you know what I mean? It's like a lot of people have an opening sequence that they're comfortable with in order to get that rapport, in order to get those juries comfortable, in order to get them talking.
So the very first thing is that I express my gratitude in a very sincere and heartfelt way for them to actually be there, taking time away from their job, their life. We take it for granted. You try a lot of cases and you think, oh, we're going to get a jury. But you have to remember the sacrifice that people are making. A lot of people live paycheck to paycheck and they don't get paid the time that they're not at work. A lot of people have childcare issues. I talk about all that. I understand what you're giving up to be here. And I want you to understand how much we all appreciate that. But I also want you to understand how important it is that you're here, because this is a very important case. And this is how our system works. And it completely collapses without jurors. So first of all, thank you for being here and being a great American and letting them kind of soak that in, because I don't know if you've ever been called for jury duty, but I, you know, I have been. And when I was down in the jury room where they pull the panels to go up, there's a lot of people who are complaining, whining, and it's a real negative feeling in there. And so I know those people are coming up to now be possibly selected to be on my jury. I want to immediately reverse that and make them have a sense of pride about being on a jury. And then that allows me to go into the next comments, which were the ones I mentioned before, about putting them at ease with the idea that it's okay to admit you're not the right person to be on this jury.
Yeah, I got called for jury selection in LA, and I actually got in the box, I got interviewed, and I mean, I didn't even ask me a question, they just looked at my background, they're like, I was out of there pretty quick, but it was just amazing, like the level of lack of preparation of these two, both lawyers that were up there. I was like, wow, I'd hate to be one of your clients, because it was like an employment case. And then I'm scheduled to go to jury selection, I think, here in Las Vegas, April 29th. I just moved here. In 53 years, I never got called for jury duty. And now I got twice. I'm not too worried about getting out of either a criminal or civil case. I think my jury duty is going to be pretty quick from past experiences. So after you get that initial connection going with them, if you talk about money in jury selection, how do you talk about it?
So absolutely, I do. I mean, I talk about all of the things that are sort of the standard checklist for a plaintiff's lawyer before you get into the particular issues of your case. Do you agree with the concept of pain and suffering? Do you agree with the concept and can work within the concept that the only way we have to make somebody whole in our civil justice system is to give them money? That in the criminal system, people go to jail, but something's taken away from somebody because they're injured. If they're paralyzed, we can't give them their ability to walk back. All we can do is compensate them with money. Is there anybody here who just fundamentally cannot accept that as a concept and could never agree with that? And I go through that first and those types of things, and then talk about what that means to give money and how the money has to match the loss. One of my best jury verdicts ever, I think, in my opinion, was under $40,000. And also I had one for $74 million. So you got to talk about whatever you're going to be doing at the end of the case. If you have a case when you're a baby lawyer, like I was, and I tried that 37,000, whatever it was case, I didn't need to prepare them for big dollars. But when you're trying a case where you are asking for millions of dollars, you do. And I don't tell them I'm going to ask for this amount, you know, and give them an actual dollar figure, because I really don't do that in opening. I usually wait to decide what my actual amount of money that I'm going to make the ask for is in closing, because I want to see how the proof comes in. But if it's millions of dollars or if it's eight figures, nine figures, whatever it is, you absolutely have to talk about that. And you have to say, look, if this person, this client, this human being who's sitting here, who this case is about, has had this loss that is catastrophic. So we just talked about how the only thing in the civil system is to award money for that. So because of the depth and the degree of this loss, the amount of money that we're going to ask you to award based on the evidence is going to be significant. And yes, it will be well into the millions of dollars. And if there's anyone who just as a fundamental concept says, I could never under any circumstance award anybody millions of dollars, let's talk about that, bringing that out of those people, and then, you know, get them off your jury.
So you mentioned the Goodwin trial, and the jury eventually gave you a verdict around of $74 million. Is that?
That's right.
That's the one you were just referencing. And you're going to do a webinar on that on April 16th. And so here's the question I have for you. It's like, what did you ask for as far as a jury verdict in that case? And how did you come up with that number?
What I like to do and what I did in this case is rather than ask for a fixed number, I say under no circumstance should this be below here. I give them a range. I say under no circumstance does the evidence in this case support you going below this number. And personally, as someone who's done these cases for years, I believe the highest should be here. So somewhere between these numbers is where justice lives. So, for example, we had three children in that case who had a negligent infliction of emotional distress. And I told, first, they saw their mother die. And that's a claim in Kentucky. And so I told the jurors that what they should award each child should be somewhere between $1 and $5 million. And they gave each child $3 million. And then similar for the loss of their parent, there's a separate claim, loss of consortium. And I think I said something like, you should give them between $3 and $9 million each. And they gave each child $5 million. So now we're at $24 million. And then the other 50 was punitive damages. And for punitive damages, what I always do is I have to tie it to some conduct, something concrete, some anchor that's purely of the defendant's conduct. And in this trial, we were grappling with that all through trial. What are we going to use? We didn't know before trial. We kept changing our minds during trial. And then they gave us a gift in the trial. And so this was a case where they had incorrectly done a road paving project and created a dangerous road by not doing things that they were required to do. And one of their defenses is, it's okay we didn't do that because we've done that at least 50 to 100 times before and the transportation cabinets never said a word to us. So I seized on that for the closing and I said, folks, what they did in this case is bad and they must be punished for it. And there's a dollar figure for that. But they just told you that they've done this at least 50 to 100 times before, which means there's at least 50 to 100 other roads in your community that this defect exists. So you're going to need to come up with a dollar figure that is for every time they've done this and the true danger that they've presented to your community. And so, you know, instead of getting what I think they probably were going to give me was $1 million in punitive damages, they gave me $50 million in punitive damages. So that is how I do the ask. That's how I come up with what it needs to be. I think handing them an actual dollar figure and saying this is what you should do can come across as a little heavy-handed, and it takes away their ability to be the decision maker, which is part of what I talk about in closing, which we'll get to later, but their empowerment, and you don't want to detract from that.
Do you talk about the burden of proof in voir dire?
I don't. I mean, I might mention it. I used to talk about it a lot. I've stopped or do it much less because I have come to the decision that I don't think it matters. I think people are either going to find for your client or they're not. I mean, punitive damages in Kentucky are clear and convincing is the standard. And liability is merely preponderance of the evidence. And when a jury, you know, like in the Godwin case, we got $50 million in punitives, but we got $24 million in compensatory. So did they decide the $24 million on preponderance of the evidence and then truly switched gears and applied? I don't think that jurors, no matter how much you define 50.1% versus 49.9% and then talk about beyond a reasonable doubt in the criminal setting, I don't think that you are going to rewire their brains in that short of a period of time.
Did you voir dire in the Goodwin trial on punitive damages?
We definitely always, just like, that's one of those preliminary checklist items, like pain and suffering and the concept of giving money. You have to voir dire on the concept of punishment.
What's your voir dire on punitives?
I use the concept of a fine. It's about being fined and that the fine has to match the conduct. And one of the things I use sometimes is I was trying a case in Chicago once, and this is a true story. And Michael Jordan was having a trial in the same courthouse in Chicago. It was like some sort of a copyright infringement or something that in one of his business deals. And I remember seeing his entourage park right in front of the courthouse and they all went inside. And I don't know if they were just unloading or whatever, but they just left their cars there. And I was like, they're gonna get a ticket. And then one of the guys on my trial team said, do you think Michael Jordan cares about a parking ticket? And so I use that. And I say, if you believe that the conduct here deserves to be punished, then the amount of money that you assess for that punishment has to be a punishment. And so if Michael Jordan, if I get a $45 parking ticket in Chicago, I'm upset. If Michael Jordan gets a $45 parking ticket in Chicago, he might park his car there every day for the rest of the trial. You're actually encouraging him to park there because he thinks that's a bargain. And so I think you have to use concepts like that, make them understand that it has to be a deterrent effect, and that some of these large corporations that you're suing, the idea that you could give them a punitive damage, you could assess punitive damages against them, and they would just take it as the cost of doing business.
So let's move on to opening statement. What is your approach and philosophy on the opening statement?
So I think it's very, very important. I think that it is the time that you make or break your case. I try a lot of complicated things. A lot of cases I try involve a lot of engineering or science or medicine, concepts that people don't address in their everyday life, a lot of rules, industry standards, FDA regulations, things that really make or break your case. And the jury has got to understand all of that. Now, you're not going to teach them the FDA regulatory system, so you have to go a different way. And the opening statement is your time, sort of your case broken down so that anybody can understand it. And if you finish opening statement and you were able to go back and ask the jury, now tell me what my case is about, and they can't, you lose the case, because you're never going to be as in control of your message as you are during opening. I mean, once your witnesses start coming on, you can be great at direct and you can try to get them to, you know, say everything you want them to say in the order you want them to say it. And hopefully they remain unscathed and cross, but that's not really how it works. So you have to have set the table in opening. So you have to break everything down. You have to look at your focus groups. What did they hang up on? What did they not understand? What was the red herring? Where were they going down the rabbit holes? And you have to figure out in your opening where to stop all of that bleeding and to make your case palatable in bite-sized pieces. Like, I use timelines. I print them out on huge boards, chronology. People love that. It anchors things. It gives them a sense of order. This has happened, then this happened, then that happened, then this happened, which never should have, then this wasn't done, which should have been done, and then this horrible thing happened to this person. That's something they can understand. So I use a lot of demonstratives in opening, and it's all about teaching.
Do you use many video clips of the defense or anything like that to undermine them, or how do you go about, if you do, undermining the defense in opening?
It depends on the case. The Godwin trial, the big defense was the driver who actually hit and killed our client's mother because of the road defect. That was our position, was he was not at fault. It was the road. But he tested positive for methamphetamine at the hospital after the accident. So we knew that was a big defense. So yes, you have to take that head on. And if you have video clips, if you have any kind of other objective evidence about things, like we had toxicology evidence that was very favorable to us in terms of what the levels of methamphetamine in his blood were and what they meant. Yeah, you have to teach all of that. Part of that opening was teaching toxicology, but not literally. I didn't want them to learn toxicology. I just wanted them to learn what they needed to know about this person's toxicology.
Let's move to your direct examinations and order of proof. The first witness out of the box, what are you trying to accomplish with that first witness?
It's a tremendous advantage about being able to go first as a plaintiff because of that first witness, because you have the ability to create the rules of the universe that the trial will be in until closing arguments. So if you have a case that involves medicine, there's certain fundamental principles, there's best practices, there's these things. For our road defect case, there is standard specifications and the manual on uniform traffic control devices and these things. There's rules for everything. Engineering, for a factory, for an assembly line, for lockout, tagout, for everything, there's rules. And so to the extent you can put an objective witness, someone who's in the case in a regulatory capacity, a rulemaking capacity, first, to tell the jury what the rules are. Because that's one of the things that the defense is definitely going to do in their case in chief, is they're going to immediately try to change the rules to show that their conduct was not violative of anything. So you have to already have ingrained in the jury's mind what the rules are. It's not having someone come in first to say, defendant broke the rules, because the jury doesn't trust you yet. You have to get what the rules are, have them be comfortable. And now the rest of the trial, they are listening to the evidence through the prism of what the rules are that you have established. And it can be through an expert witness if you don't have, in a traffic case, a motor vehicle accident case, you may have a police officer who just talks about right-of-way and stopping and letting people go and pulling out in front of someone. People know that. They drive every day. But just to be reminded, these are the rules, and this is what happened in this case. That, for me, is the most important thing you can do in terms of order of proof. After that, it's going to depend on the facts of your case. Do you need to get your expert on immediately after that? Do you have experts on multiple issues and you have to slide experts in between lay witnesses so that the story is progressing and that each expert is coming into the story when it matters? That's sort of the art of trying a case.
So in the, in your road defect case, who was your first witness out of the box?
So our first witness out of the box was the chief engineer for that district from the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet. And I just took him through the rules of that paving project, what was supposed to have been done. And the whole time we are referencing the actual documents from the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet, the contract, what was supposed to be done. There were schematics, there were diagrams, and we're putting those up on the screen, or we have boards of those. He's pointing to them. He's explaining how this road was supposed to have been paved. That, and it wasn't optional, and that it had to be done this way. And then we counter that with photographs of how it was actually done and have him explain how that's not meeting the rule. We had experts on roads, and we called them later in the case. But he was objective, and he was just there so that now every other witness that gets up, the jury understands what that road job required, what the road was supposed to have looked like, and what it actually looked like, and how that wasn't right. Tremendous advantage for us moving forward through the rest of the proof.
And regarding the rest of the proof, as far as like the sequencing of liability versus damages witnesses, how do you go about mixing that up, or do you get all the damages, see all the liability done first and then just go to damages and call the plaintiff at the end? How does that work?
We had basically three phases. We had prove that the defendant did it wrong. Then we had to exonerate the other driver who was on meth. Then we had to prove our damages. And we did it just in that order. We didn't want to get bogged down with meth in the beginning. So we purposefully put on the case against the defendant before getting into that. And that was really, really important, because we got them so good on liability. I called the driver who was on meth in my case in chief. I had to bring that right out into the forefront. But we turned him into an expert witness on roads. And he was a guy who drove a concrete worker who had a big work truck, flatbed for the concrete equipment. And I asked him if he'd ever dropped a tire off the road before, and how do you get back on without losing control? And he knew all that. And I said, well, why didn't it work this time? And he talked about how the edge of the road was just so much more vertical and higher than anything he'd ever seen before. He couldn't get his tire back over. And so we went on and on about that. And then on his cross, they had to deal with that. And they spent more time arguing with him about the road condition than they did about his meth. It was very, very good for us. But in this case, and in most cases, I believe that you have to prove your case first. And then once you feel like you've won your case, then leave the jury with the damages.
So in Huntington Beach, to switch gears just for a second, because I always try to remember what a lot of people I'm talking to, but in Huntington Beach, you're going to talk on depositions and one other subject. Is that correct?
Yes. The other thing I'm going to talk about is, do you have a road defect case? Because I think a lot of folks underestimate the role that road conditions play, especially in single car accidents or in collisions where the person that calls you is listed on the police report as being the at-fault driver, and they turn the case down. And if they just dig a little deeper, they might realize they have a heck of a good case because the entire collision occurred due to the road. And so I'm going to talk about what you can do when these cases come into your office so that you're not letting those cases slip through the cracks.
Right. And just make sure everybody knows, Huntington Beach, the conference is going to be June 5th through 8th at the Paseo Hotel. It's going to be the greatest trial lawyers conference ever. Not just because Ron Johnson's making his debut there, but that's part of it, because you know, you have to get to a certain level of credibility in the community before people from Louisville of the status show up. Because we got the whole hotel, which is great. So it's a great hotel, 250 rooms. Every room's got a balcony, an ocean view. The food's great, but some of the greatest trial lawyers in the country are coming. And there's going to be 4 lecture tracks and 8 workshop tracks and really cool theme parties every night. I was initially a fan of theme parties until we started having them. And they're a lot more fun when people dress up just a little bit. I mean, I can't wait to see you at the, we're going to have, a Ken and Barbie party. See, that's going to be a little different, a little pink and white action. So we have a lot of creative things we're doing for the event in Huntington Beach to make it great. And besides having the great trial lawyers, it's going to be super fun too, which is important because life is not always so fun as a trial lawyer or as a practicing lawyer. So when we get away, it's good to combine great learning with great fun and making a lot of new friends. This is the plan in Huntington Beach. And then Vegas is going to be in October at Caesar's Palace. So that's going to be quite a bit bigger because last time we did Vegas was 2022. So got that 2-year hiatus to help me refine my skills as a conference planner, but there's a lot that goes into these things, but I'm pretty stoked about that.
Let me just jump in on that and just say that I really appreciate what you've done with Trial Lawyers University, because I think at the beginning of this, you were talking about the fact that not everyone who becomes a plaintiff's lawyer, trial lawyer, has the chance to have some great mentor. But what your conference does is it gives you like a panel of mentors. And I'm excited not just to be speaking there, but to go hear some of the other speakers, because that's the best way to learn as a trial lawyer, is to learn from those who have done it and have succeeded. And so you putting these together really is a great way for not just young trial lawyers, but even ones who've been around for a long time. Always good to learn new things. And that's what you're offering here.
Well, thanks. You've got to constantly be learning. And it's great too, because, you know, for a lot of the folks, you know, getting a personal connection with somebody that's very experienced and successful helps a lot, because if you actually have their cell phone number and you have an issue they can help you with and they know who you are, there's a lot better chance they're going to answer the phone when you call and actually take the time to analyze the situation. Because you can't just expect to pick the phone up and, you know, pick somebody's brain that doesn't know you and have them be really focused on what your problem is. But if you have a connection, then they're much more likely to, because then they can, you know, often empathize and put themselves in your shoes. Remember what it was like to be young and not know and not have had this experience. And you've had the experience and you're able to share it and like help other people avoid those pitfalls and those obstacles to success. And it's a great feeling, honestly, because losing sucks. Injustice sucks. Being part of an injustice, even though you tried your best, doesn't make you feel like people are like, oh, you did your best. I'm like, my client lost, especially as a criminal defense lawyer. It's like, my guy's still in jail this Christmas, okay? And next Christmas and the one after that. So it's really no consolation doing your best. This is about winning. It's like doing your best for a family and you lose. That doesn't help any. I mean, it's crazy, but how much, it's just a tough business, tough job, a lot of emotional drain. So we got to keep getting better. That's why, you know, one of the things I really love about what I get to do now is like, I'm learning. I get to learn so much and meet so many great people and get their perspective on this complex thing called a trial. I am blessed in this way, for sure. Other ways too, but this way too, get to know people. Moving on to cross-examination, especially of experts, because those are obviously the most challenging crosses, much more than the lay witnesses. So you talked about the deposition process. And of course, that begins the cross. examination. Because if you don't have good depositions, I think it probably takes a lot of wind out of the cross. But give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I mean, I think for most trial lawyers, and definitely for me, cross-examination is where I live. I absolutely love it. I'm amazed when I do see trials from other attorneys and I watch the cross and they do not take advantage of what they're being given. It's all about control. It's about taking total control of the witness and not giving them an inch to make any of their own speeches or statements. And if you're not doing that, if you're not comfortable, if you don't have the demeanor to be a controlling person, then you should let your second chair or your co-counsel cross. I mean, forget all the other things that I'm going to talk about. If you can't grab them by their shirt collar, figuratively, and take control of what they're going to say, you're testifying through them. You're a ventriloquist. They're the dummy at that point. And if you don't approach it like that, and not every single cross should be that way. There are times when you get up to cross someone and they didn't really hurt you. They could possibly be willing to help you. You can be more gentle with those people. But for most witnesses, you have got to take control. That's what I do. And I'm very comfortable doing that. And most of the time, not most, but a significant portion of the time when I'm crossing someone, I'm looking not at them, I'm looking at the jury. And I'm testifying to the jury and just getting them to agree with what I'm saying. And I'm putting all of the testimony that I want from their mouth in my words that matches up exactly with what I told them was going to happen in opening. And I just have them agreeing on it. And then if you have really done your job in depositions, like in the Godwin trial, I never had to get out a deposition to impeach a witness with a prior inconsistent statement because we made boards of everything good for us that they said in their depositions. And we actually turned them into, we had a rule board and then we had fact boards and all the facts broke the rules. So the first thing I did was get them to admit that those were the rules, and they had said they had conceded that in their depositions. And then I got them to go through the facts, which were written on each board to clearly show that they broke a rule. And then you have their check mark or their initials, whatever you want to do, on those boards for closing. So that was one tool that we did there. The other thing I'll say, you know, you asked specifically about experts, and I'll just mention this real briefly. You've got to know, if you're doing an expert, know everything. Know all the literature. All you have to do to beat an expert in cross is everything. You have to know everything. And I'll give you one quick example. I'm trying a pharmaceutical case in an MDL, a bellwether case, and I'm crossing an expert about the clinical trials and about the FDA advisory committee meeting. And I know that this expert is trying to spin what came out of that advisory committee meeting to mean something that it didn't. Well, what he doesn't know is I went to that advisory committee meeting. I was there. So I start off my cross with him with, and there was an advisory committee meeting, isn't that correct? Yes, and that's something that's put on by the FDA, right? And for that, they bring in doctors from around the country, don't they? Yes. This was at that Marriott in Bethesda, Maryland, correct? And he looks at me like, what? I go, yeah, the Marriott. Remember, it was in ballroom B, and they had the tables set up in that square, and all the doctors that they brought in were sitting around that square. Do you remember that, sir? And this guy at this point is going, how does he know the configuration of the room from the advisory committee meeting? And at that point, he was scared to disagree with anything I said because he didn't know what I knew. And you think, well, what are the odds that you were at the, but it can be anything like that. You just have to show the expert that you know everything. And if you do that, you're not going to get them to lie, but that's not what we're trying to do on cross. We're just trying to get them to tell the truth because what they've been hired to do is lie. And we just need to get them to tell the truth. And that's how you do it. It all goes back to just having total control.
As far as literature goes, do you use much literature when crossing your experts?
I don't use the literature unless they misrepresent it. And then it's Katie bar the door. I mean, I think literature is a double-edged sword. It can be dangerous for you because there's often things buried in the article, in the sort of dicta, that can be misconstrued. But I did a bunch of cases involving hormone replacement stuff, and a lot of those experts were just blatantly misrepresenting what those articles said. And then to get the actual article and get up there on cross with them and just make them look foolish was very powerful. But you have to know the literature. You have to know. So when they write their report and they say, this article supports my position on this, and this article supports my position on that, you need to go pull those articles and you need to read them. And if you don't understand them, you need to go to your expert and say, explain this article to me. What's buried in this data? I don't understand. What's a confidence interval? Why is this confidence interval too wide? I don't understand epidemiology. And you have to understand it. And then you can go back on cross when the expert realizes that you actually know that article better than he or she does, then you win. Then you're in control.
Speaking of winning, let's move on to the closing argument, where now you finally decide how much you're going to ask for, I guess, place the value on it, all that stuff. So, well, first, when do you start preparing your closing argument?
I prepare my closing argument. Usually I start a couple weeks after I sign the case up. And I just am my partner Jay is very technological. He didn't have a piece of paper in his office, but I'm old school and I've got yellow pads everywhere. And I keep a yellow pad in every file where every time something comes to me, and sometimes it's after I go to their house for something, to get something signed, or after a deposition, just things that you're doing in the case are going to just jar certain thoughts, certain moments of creativity that are inspired. And if you don't write that down, you're never going to bring all that back when you're putting your closing argument together, you know, before trial, during trial, or night before closing. So I'm doing that for how long the case lasts, 2-3 years. I'm constantly writing things down and just keeping them, keeping all that. And then going back through it and seeing what still resonates and how it ties together. So, you know, there's some version of closing argument that I could be prepared to give on the first day of trial, but certainly throughout the trial, then part of what I'm doing every night is refining that and not waiting until the night before closing arguments to finally come up with it, but also not pre-recording it too much. You can't pre-package your closing and think, this is my closing back 2 weeks before trial, because it's not going to be fresh. It's not going to be adapted to the evidence that the jury saw. And you don't want the jury listening to your closing argument and saying, what trial did that guy listen to? It has to be relatable and relevant to what the jury heard. So I don't really finalize it until that sort of night before.
Do you have your clients present typically for the closing?
I do, but I don't always have them present during trial. And for example, in the Godwin trial, our clients were 3 children. And we told the jury, I told them in opening, that they weren't going to be in the courtroom for most of the trial. And that was due to the fact that just listening to all of the evidence, the story come in about how their mother died, and that we would have to show photographs, the 911 call, their therapist, the child psychologist who saw them afterwards, the witness who got them out of the car, they can't handle that. But I did bring them in for closing because, and I told the jury, they need to be here now, that they can handle this and they deserve this. And I did something in closing to justify the damages that we were asking for, because we were asking for a lot of money, that I could not have done if they hadn't been sitting there.
And what was that?
It triggered emotional response in me that I wasn't prepared for. But the children were sitting at the table and I was talking about the money and I did those ranges like we talked about. And I said, so you may think that sounds like, when you do that for 3 children, you may think that sounds like a lot of money. And I said, I want you to think about this. If you wrote that money out onto a check and you put it on this table right here where they're sitting, and you gave them a choice and you said, you can pick up that check and you can walk out those doors. And I pointed to the doors, the main doors of the courtroom that go to the outside. I said, you can walk out those doors and never come back. Or you can tear that check up and you can walk through that door. And I pointed to the door to the jury room. And you can tell these three kids, you can walk through that door and you'd get to spend 1 hour with your mother. Their mother would be in there alive and they would get 1 hour with her. I go, which door do you think they would walk through? And the jury was crying and I was emotional. It made the check seem like, what is this amount of money we're asking for if they would tear that up for just one more hour with their mother? So that was a good, compelling way to make the money seem less consequential because, you know, we live in a society that's about money and people think, oh, that's too much money. But you, when you can bring it down to what you're actually compensating for in a way that is emotional and connects with the jurors, clearly it worked.
Clearly. Let's rebuttal. Because in Kentucky, you have rebuttal? Or you just, because there's some states you just have a close and an opening, so.
Yeah, so in federal court, we have, of course, we have rebuttal. But in Kentucky, the defendant goes first in closing and the plaintiff goes last. So it's kind of like the rebuttal's wrapped up in it from the beginning. So when I try cases in federal court, I certainly have rebuttal. When I try cases in Ohio, we have the rebuttal system. I'm happy either way. I mean, I love our system in Kentucky, but I like having the rebuttal too. And I will reserve a significant amount of time for rebuttal. And it kind of becomes second closing. But yeah, I mean, I shove as much of the defendant's closing as I can right up their ass, excuse my language, because they say things that are just unbelievable. And it just makes you, sometimes I hear the things that they say and I say, are you a human being? And you have to showcase that. You have to shine a spotlight on it. That's one thing I think that that you get better at as you try more cases. And it goes back to cross-examination also, is that when you get a win, when you nail somebody on something, don't move on. You only got one trial. You know how significant that was, but the jury may not. I tried a case once against this defense lawyer from Chicago named Jim Hurst. One of the best trial lawyers I've ever seen. I lost. The rumor is he gets paid some absurd amount of money a year and he tries the hardest cases, and I can see why. He was great. But one of the things I learned from him was he got my expert on a couple things. He didn't move on. Whenever he got my expert, he just made the expert roll around it. And really just, there was no way that that was going to get missed by the jury. And I think you got to do that in your cross. I think you got to do that in your closing. They get up and say something ridiculous about a child losing their mother, not being worth a lot of money. I mean, you got to exploit that. That's one of the great things about the rebuttal side.
Yeah. And so obviously you had a mentor and helped you, guide you in your career. So many people get out of law school, like my nephew's taking the bar exam shortly. And people that want to become trial lawyers. Because it's a hard thing to figure out how to become a great trial lawyer. Because if you want to become like a great basketball player, you start playing when you're young and there's set training protocols. You get a coach, or golf, you take a lesson. But it's really harder to figure out this whole thing, becoming a great trial lawyer. Because there's so many nuances to it, somewhat personality dependent and yada, yada, yada. But you know, what advice would you give to, you know, a young person who's just getting their bar, just getting their ticket and they're saying, no, because you knew you wanted to be a trial lawyer from the beginning. That's why you took the job paying $30,000 instead of $80,000, because the experience would you get. And most kids these days, I don't think, have that ability to look past that immediate paycheck because of whatever. It's desperation for money, greed, necessity. I don't know what it is. But what advice would you give to a young person who wants to become a trial lawyer?
I think the biggest advice would be the part where you learn how to be the tactician, the sort of strategy, taking a good deposition, writing a good opening statement, doing a thorough voir dire. Anybody can learn any of that. I think what makes you a great trial lawyer is what we're doing is so hard. We go into the courtroom And the jury knows that as we arrive there, it's all been in the defendant's favor already for however many years. And why not just leave it there? Why overturn all of that and change the truth and make the plaintiff now the winner? So you have to connect. There has to be a genuineness. And so what I would tell a young lawyer is, look, is that in you? Is that part of who you can be, that you can be that level, you can have that level of empathy, that you can believe in your client 110%, that you're willing to do anything to win for them and that they are right? And if that's true, if you can do that, if you can summon that up in you, then be you. Because I remember when I was a young lawyer, I was going to all these seminars, much like not nearly as good as what you're putting on.
Good thing you have that caveat or we're going to have a problem. Go ahead.
Right. But you hear these people speak and you can learn from them and you should learn from them, but you can't become them. And so when I was a young lawyer, there were certain trial lawyers out there, legendary nationwide trial lawyers. And I would go hear this one and I'd say, okay, I'm going to do everything like that now. And then I go hear this one and I say, oh, no, I'm going to do everything like that now. And I remember my boss, Joe White, said, you got to be Ron Johnson. You can't be this guy or that guy. You can use the tools that they teach you. And certainly everyone who comes to Trial Lawyers University is getting a lot more tools to put in their toolbox. And having the right tools, that's how you get the job done. But you have to be you. And so my advice to young lawyers would be, do you have it, the empathy, the caring to be a plaintiff's lawyer? And are you willing to be yourself using the tools that you get from a place like Trial Lawyers University?
Well, it's interesting you talk about connection because, you know, when I got to sit through the pandemic, I was in all by myself. So that's why I started doing these webinars, because I was trying to figure out what are the secret ingredients to getting big verdicts? Because let's just say it like it is. The only way we judge trial lawyers, at least in the plaintiff's world, is the size of their verdicts. So what's the secret? And by sitting through, like, this is probably did over, I think I've done over 350 webinars now with people at the top of the game, whether some famous, some not, but like, it's amazing how many great lawyers are you've never heard of. And I realized there's three elements to getting a big verdict. The first one is having a great case, right? Having a case that's got the evidence. It's got liability, it's got damages, and it's got a big insurance policy. Because if it doesn't have those things, it ain't a great case. It might be a righteous case, but it may not be a great case. And then after that, when you have that big pile of evidence, you got to have trial strategy. You got to know how to, you know, if you got 500 pieces of evidence, you got to know how to sequence that evidence. You got to whittle it down because you can't show that much, right? You got to figure out what's really necessary for the jury to see and understand in order to decide in my favor for the amount that I want. And that takes a lot of experience. And that's what we, you know, kind of learn through webinars and going to conferences. You learn trial strategy, which is, you know, cross-examination, sequencing of witnesses we talked about. And that's critical. But the third element that people don't really think of and don't practice is that connection. That the whole, after you get to walk into that courtroom, the whole game is a game of connection. And connection, it can be trained. I've been working, trying to figure this out, and you know that comfort level of being yourself. Because people say be yourself, but you can't be yourself if you're nervous and insecure in front of people. Because people don't connect with fear. Because why are you afraid if you're right? And so that's why I like, okay, I got to work on this part of it. And so over the last couple of years, been really honing this workshop that I've developed, training the connection, the nonverbal skills of connection, eye contact, facial expression control, so that matches. So if you say good morning to everybody, you have a warmth on your face, not like good morning, everybody. Like, you know, you're like, you're about to perform surgery. Or if you ask a question, like, you know, to look curious, like you're interested in them and the movement of your hands and the pace of your voice. Cause most people speed up. Cause we were just doing yesterday, a buddy of mine, student of mine, Ike was over. We did a focus group, you know, over at Panish's office and came back to my place. And he said, big screen behind me, replayed it. And every part of it kind of showed where things may not be so good, you know, speaking too fast, bad word selection, not paying attention, and get to replay it because he's doing the best he could, right? I mean, you get up in front of even a mock jury, you're doing the best you can on your voir dire. But to take it where somebody where the best they are and then replaying it and giving them the techniques of slowing down and having them get up and practice in front of like the group of lawyers is here. To me, it's like, because then you could practice the skills, because that's why you get, you know, to court, obviously get the skills of the courtroom. And so it's so important to practice that connection. And I know that we talked earlier, you said you don't really practice your opening statements or closing argument these days, being more experienced as you did when you were young. But I think it's so critical that people practice so they're comfortable.
Right.
Because that gives them confidence. And obviously, I think so much, it's like golf. So much of the game is between your ears. You know how to hold a club, you know how to swing, you get an idea, but the difference in the backstroke, it's just like the difference between being on the driving range and being on at the first tee. It's like, it's the same stroke, but it's amazing how good that ball can fly at the driving range. And as soon as you stand up there, it just dribbles off, and you're like, ugh. Yeah. And so anyways, the connection is the game. And it's interesting you brought that up. You're doing another webinar on depositions on March 8th. So tell us, for people that are interested in getting better at depositions, what will they glean from that webinar that you're presenting on?
So I'm going to talk about the importance of depositions and that you have to have that to win your trial. So people say, well, that's easy to say. How do you get that in the deposition? And so we're going to go through getting what you need, adapting your style for types of depositions. There's many different types of depositions you take in a case, and you need to be a different kind of lawyer in each one of those cases or each one of those types to get what you need from those persons. And so I'm going to give examples of, like, if you're deposing the investigating officer in a motor vehicle accident and you need him to change what his conclusion was in the accident report, how do you do that in a deposition? What do you have to be like? Versus a deposition of maybe the corporate rep in a 30B6 of a company that did some bad stuff, and you need to get them to admit that there are rules and then get them to say the things that you can use to prove they broke the rules. And how do you do that? How do you take control of a deposition like that? How do you not give up in a deposition like that? Because they don't just come out and admit those things in the first answer. You have to be dogged. How do you deal with the fact that you have a defense lawyer who's trying to derail you at every turn? So there are ways, tactics that I have developed over 24 years now of having taken thousands of depositions, to the point where now when I walk out of depositions, I don't have that feeling of, oh, I wish I had asked this, or why didn't I do that this way? Instead, I walk out and go, I can't wait to see this transcript because we got them. And that's what we're going to be talking about in that webinar.
All right. And if you can't make the March 8th or the April 16th webinars, everything that we've ever done, is including all the live programs from Las Vegas and Huntington Beach and, you know, Marina Del Rey, we did the Pandas Trial College, has all been recorded. And it's on TLU On Demand, or Trial Lawyers University On Demand, which is also an app for your phone. So, and if you shoot me an email at dan@trial lawyers university, or if you don't have it, I'm happy to give you a 30-day trial subscription, because that way you can see what you're missing, because you got to always keep learning. Oh, and for Huntington Beach in Vegas, there's no reason not to learn. So if you need tuition assistance, nobody's ever been denied tuition assistance or scholarships at TLU. So if you just send me an email explaining your situation at dan@trial lawyers university, we will address it and make sure that if you want to be there, we'll do everything we can do to help you get there. You still have to get there, but we can help. So anyways, hey, Ron, it was great spending this morning with you and getting to know you a lot better and your trial history. And I look forward to seeing you on March 8th, March 16th, but especially on June 4th in Huntington Beach, because that's where it's so great too, because I get better at planning these things. So on Tuesday, June 4th, because June 5th is just workshops. There's no lectures, so it's a smaller group. But a lot of people have to get in on June 4th that are going to have class on June 5th. So on June 4th in the afternoon, we're going to have a little pool and cabana get together, because it's the beach in the summer in Southern California. Like, it's the best. I know Louisville's great. You got those horse races, but the beach and the ocean breeze and having every breakfast and lunch outdoors and all the parties outdoors with the beach breeze is the best. And after that, on the 4th, we're going to have the happy hour social, because I have the presidential suite for all five nights of the conference too. So it's always good to have a hangout place. We're going to have the game lounge in the entrance of the hotel. It's going to be really kick-ass. So anyways, we look forward to it in person. So good visiting with you. Appreciate it all.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate it. And I'm really looking forward to Trial Lawyers University.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by Law Pods.